Hey everyone, welcome back to Culture Binge, the Wisecrack podcast where we talk about stuff that's happening in places where we are. I'm your host Michael Burns, joined by two times in a row a guest Rachel Van Ness. Rachel, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Awesome. I want to ask how you are, but I knew it was going to interrupt the flow and I just did anyway.
I get really chatty when you ask me that, so just always assume good. We're also joined by someone who's, I don't think, ever been on this podcast, but has been on some Wisecrack things and some other things that one might have heard of, Billy Domino. Billy, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm coming to you live from Brooklyn, which is a different place than you are.
That's amazing. I must say that the last time Billy was supposed to be on a Wisecrack podcast, he was slated to be on an episode of The Squanch, our Rick and Morty show. The last minute gave us a very horrible excuse about some made-up job that he had to interview for. But then I saw on the internet like a week later, he was joining the writing staff at Saturday Night Live. So that's the one reason why you're allowed to flake out on us. And congrats publicly about that, Billy. That's so fun.
Thank you very much. To sort of an adjacent story to that is the last time I actually was on The Squanch, I was telling people and the, pitch your stuff at the end, I was telling people to vote for me in the Writers Guild upcoming board elections. Yeah. And everyone should know that out of 19 candidates, I came in 19th. So thank you so much for all your support. I really made a lot of enemies within the writing labor community. So it's going great.
Well, you're working, so that's great. And I think you've just proven that either our audience is made up completely of WGA members who absolutely hate you, or this is a podcast that is frowned upon by members of the WGA community. So sadly, no one was able to vote for you.
We know it's the former.
It is. It is. Couple quick things when we get going. I'm curious, are either of you all watching the Winter Olympics that are currently taking place in scenic Beijing, China?
I have caught glimpses of the Winter Olympics because my boyfriend's parents are in town. And so when I've been in the hotel room with his parents, it's been on. So I've caught a couple of clips of the Winter Olympics.
I have not, and that's really, really hard for me because I am about as big a Winter Olympics stan as you're going to find anywhere. I love them to no end. I will watch any event. I truly don't understand how people don't think they're the better Olympics. You have people, almost every sport involves flying down a mountain at 90 miles an hour, and I just don't understand why that's more less appealing to most people than running. Like, I guess you run, but I don't watch movies to see people do what I do. Okay, take it or leave it. But I have not watched any just because I've been so put off by just how truly awful every aspect of the planning has been on the part of the Chinese and part of the International Olympic Committee. And just it is just laid bare how fucking craven this entire system is. And I'm someone who for years has been like, oh yeah, I know the Olympics are terrible. I know no city should host them. I really hope Boston hosts the Olympics. That'd be kind of cool in my hometown. But just like, no, even I can't get behind this. And it's just, maybe I'll come back in 2026, but it's just too depressing. Also, man-made snow, and man-made snow sucks for skiing.
It's bad snow. It's objectively bad snow. I have been watching a ton of it because I just get so obsessed with the Olympics in general, with the Winter Olympics in particular. I agree that it is the better games because you can have almost no knowledge of most of the sports and within minutes have a very fun time watching them. And like, I find myself commentating on things and disagreeing with judges on sports that I've known existed for like 7 minutes. But the snow sucks, and there's like weird nuclear generators behind these man-made ski slopes, which look really ugly. And nothing's more of an example of like a thing where the athletes, many of whom are not rich or famous and work their asses off for years just to be in this position, to be in an event run by the most just disgusting, craving, power-hungry, corrupt individuals in the planet. A real opposites attract type thing, I guess. But yeah, the other big question I had for everyone was who has seen Jackass Forever since it came out a week and a half ago?
I have not, but I did watch Encanto finally.
Oh, which is the Jackass Forever of animated children's stories.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
Wow. Then I'll just ask you, Billy. A, did you like it? B, who did you think was the MVP of Jackass Forever?
Okay, so yes, I did like it. The MVP in terms of like, it's just not a movie without them, is definitely Danger Aaron. Just putting his body out there time and time again. It also did reaffirm my love in terms of on-camera personality for Dave England. He is just so sweet and so naive, and his terror is so basic and real. But it's even like other guys will be like screaming and like ready to shit their pants and like screaming no fucking way, and he'll just be quietly in the corner like, I don't want to do this. And that's something that's so beautifully refreshing. I know you've talked about how it's this the ultimate perfect rejection of traditional toxic masculinity, and he really falls right in the center of that line.
I love those guys. Aaron and Dave are just the best, the Pacific Northwest fellas. And Aaron McGehee in particular does things in the new film which were shockingly brave and incredible, especially the thing involving the bear. But yeah, just a great movie. We talked about it a little bit on the last episode of this show, just in preparation for the film. So in case anyone was wondering, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's so much fun. Go with your friends and you'll have fun. Go without your friends and you'll feel like you're laughing with your friends, even if you're there alone, because no one's truly alone at a screening of Jackass Forever. We are sponsored by Paramount, to be clear. So before we get like all the way into it, we do have to do our traditional segment, Slaps and Chaps. This is the part where we talk about something we're liking that slaps and something we don't like, the chaps. As everyone knows, I didn't invent these words. I wanted to change it, and the listeners have said, please don't. So I will continue to say slaps and chaps until the audience democratically decides I'm allowed to not. Billy, as a first-timer, we'll start with you. What are your slaps and chaps on this, the week of, I don't know, Valentine's Day?
And does it have to be something that like is like new and fresh, or
this is about you?
Okay, this is about me. Then I guess what's slapping for me right now is going back and rewatching Jackass 3. You know, we won't call it Jackass 3D unless you have the gear for it. But as much as I did like Jackass Forever, what's very clear is one, lower budget. Two, they're getting older and they're obviously bringing in the new folks who can hopefully carry this on. And three, there were limitations in terms of caused by COVID in terms of what they could do publicly, how many people they could have on set, things like that. What if you really do want to see the height of what this genre can be, though, and you haven't seen it before, go back to Jackass 3, because they have a fucking budget for that one and they use it brilliantly. The ones that come to mind for me always are Electric Avenue, which I won't spoil for anyone. You'll know it when you're there. And also there is an extended set piece that just revolves around. They get like an F-16 fighter jet. They turn it on full blast while parked, and they just start throwing shit into its tail wake at, you know, 200 miles an hour, using it as a pitching machine, basically, and anything else they could imagine to throw into the 500-degree exhaust of a fighter jet. It also, and what makes that movie so amazing, is they have a big music budget, and you realize how much the right classic rock pairing with any of these events can really just bring to a whole new level of art.
Amazing. I second that slap. I hate to bring anything negative to light after talking about something so glorious, but how about your chap? What is making you feel the opposite of Jackass 3?
I mean, of course, there are little things that aren't culturally specific. Yesterday I weighed myself and I was at a new maximum. That was fun to not, and I didn't expect it. That was the thing. And there's definitely not body recomposition going on. But you know what? Let's go back to where we started earlier, rather than mining new hatred in my brain. Let's talk about the Winter Olympics. But I'm not going to talk about why it sucks this year. But what chaps me is everyone hating on the Winter Olympics in general. Again, come on, it's just nothing but speed and absolute danger. They're flying towards, you know, the equivalent of concrete and just walls of ice and snow. If I hear one more people say like, oh God, ski jumping, I wouldn't want to try that. You don't want to try it? Really? You don't want to fly through the air? In a way, that's actually pretty safe. You're probably only 20 feet off the ground at any given time. It's a sloped hill. You're going down with the slope. And also, like, as long as we're doing this event that we say is, oh, it's a celebration of amateur athletes everywhere, and anyone can be there. When, of course, we know it all sort of depends, you know, in 95% of cases on whose parents could send them to gymnastics camp, or at the very least, which country is rich. Let's celebrate the seasonal Olympics that are fully embrace how isolated or how closed off they are. Half of these sports were invented to keep like the princes of the European small states busy in the 1870s. A bobsled is not a natural device. Like, this is just, they figured out something to do so that the richest people in Europe could feel a thrill. And it is somehow that has evolved into what we see as a winter sport. It's all made up, but it's amazing. So,
and don't the, yeah,
you shouldn't
know,
hate.
I just want 19th century European princes to be happy. Yeah. Rachel, how about
you? I have
you?
So little going for them.
Yeah. Rachel, what are your slaps and chaps?
Yeah. Mine are Valentine's Day themed. My slap is actually doing something for Valentine's Day. I've been with my boyfriend for 8 years, and we have never done anything on Valentine's Day because I am like the punky teenager who's very much like, Valentine's Day is stupid. It's a corporate holiday. Who fucking cares? But this year I've been trying to be more intentional about being sort of like, wouldn't it just be more fun if we just believed it? Like, wouldn't that be fun? So this time we actually like very intentionally made plans, which has never happened before. And it was exciting. But that leads to my chat. What chaps is that we, I won't mention the name of this restaurant, but we did go to a restaurant that had like a tasting menu, and I had never done that before. And you know, I'm just not a fancy food small plates gal, I discovered. I think like at a certain price point, you get diminishing returns on food. And for me, I'm about like a maximum $30 for a meal kind of a gal, like, which is like substantial enough. It's not like full on foodie maybe, but yeah. So I guess I learned that about myself, is I'm not really the type of person who's going to go to a restaurant, because we starved ourselves all day for this. And then we like left at 10 p.m. still starving. So that's my chap, is like fine dining, I guess.
Wow. I will slightly second that chap, in that I tried to last minute do something for Valentine's Day. Made a reservation at a place that had a tasting menu, showed up, and they were an hour and a half behind on seating. So we stood for a while, eventually bailed, and ended up picking some Taiwanese food up on the way home and watching The Bachelor and eating Taiwanese food.
That sounds amazing. That sounds perfect.
It was fine. It was fine. I'll quickly do my slaps and chaps. My slap is, I've recently done the thing where I've seen the same movie a few times, multiple times in the theater. What a lovely thing to do, especially, you know, if you have like a AMC A-list or the Alamo season pass or any of these things where you're not really spending more money to do it. It's a great way to see a movie multiple times. You notice things you didn't notice the first time that you still wouldn't notice on the small screen or watching it at home. And then if you really enjoy a movie, you're just hanging out with old friends at that point. So I just recommend, if you have one of those movie passes, you haven't been doing it, pick a movie you liked, or even that you weren't sure if you liked, see it again. And then you also know exactly when to go to the bathroom, which is great.
How many times is too many times? Have you hit that?
I will say that my spouse cut me off from the Paul Thomas Anderson film Licorice Pizza at 5.
Oh, so, my God.
But to be fair, one of the 5 was one where PTA and Alana Haim were doing like a Q&A thing. So I mostly went for that part. So really 4, but it was a lot. But it got to the point I just wanted to hang out with my friends Gary and Alana in mid-70s San Fernando Valley, and no one was going to tell me I couldn't. So there you go. So do that. I plan to see, you know, Jackass Forever a few times. My chap, really quickly, it kind of touches on Billy's. This has to do with the Winter Olympics. This is a bad take. People don't agree with me on this, but I will just say this. I hate Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir. They have spent the last 2 days bullying a 15-year-old Russian girl. We can maybe be mad that someone took some of Grandpa's heart medicine they weren't supposed to give them more endurance, but pills don't make you able to do quadruple spins and stuff like that. The pills aren't going to do that. You do that. And it's just like really brutal. You're from like one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Every 4 years, we think you're important because you go on TV in your outfits. And just the meanness towards a 15-year-old. I just can't do it. Now, if a 15-year-old is like an overt Nazi, sure, let's be mean to them. But a 15-year-old who we know probably got pressured by a coach to take some pills or whatever, I don't know. And all I just kept thinking, too, about athletics is, and this, once again, this is a bad take. I know this is wrong, what I'm about to say. But all I could think is, in a lot of other sports, if someone found out someone was doping, it would be even more motivation for an athlete to cleanly win. So if I'm an American figure skater, I'm not going to do social media posts where I preemptively make excuses for why I'm not winning a medal. I'm going out there and saying, I did it clean, and I'm going to beat your ass. Now, the skater in question, Camila Valaveva, did not. She, I think, is finished fourth ultimately. But I just don't like to watch adults bully 15-year-olds on TV. Please, everyone who's listening to this, tell me why I'm wrong, because I've said this publicly in a couple ways and I've gotten told why I'm deeply wrong. But it is what it is.
I just want to be 100% clear on this. If Kyle Rittenhouse took heart medication, you would support Kyle Rittenhouse?
Oh, cut that.
That's
cut
what you're
that
saying.
I would not say that. And if Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir stood up against white terrorist shooters, which they haven't, I would support them. But I would say, Johnny and Tara, where are you at on these issues? On that note, reminder as always, like and subscribe and review the podcast. It means a lot to us when you do. So go on iTunes and do that. Write reviews. Have fun with your reviews, you know? Maybe evaluate the podcast as if you were two angry but fashionable Olympic ice skating judges. I don't know. But we have two main topics we're going to talk about today. One, which tickles my heart, relates to the website twitter.com, a place where I spend far too much time, a place where, you know, I miss Billy's presence on the website twitter.com, but I completely understand why he is not there anymore, and I am envious of the fact he is not there anymore. I'm sure you lurk, but, you know, not publicly. Sorry if that was putting you on blast. You can cut that if
no,
you don't like it.
No, it's all good. I got off of Twitter when I got the job just because I'm like, I don't want to spend any mental place in this hellhole anymore. But I actually did like a week ago recreate my account just because I realized like I'm, aside from NPR, I'm not getting any news. Like, and I just sort of do need to be able to lurk a little bit to see like, okay, what are people angry about? Because maybe it's tangential to something real.
Yeah, and something people were angry about last week. I'll intro us and we can talk about it. So a writer who writes in New Jersey named Jeremy Schneider basically became the antagonist of, you know, grown-up gifted kid Twitter for around 24 hours after he tweeted, quote, "Please know, if you're someone who brings a book to the bar, nobody likes you." And then his mentions were filled with, you know, various liberal arts graduates very upset that he would say such a thing. He got lots of negative stories. However, in the replies, there were some really nice stories of people talking about experiences in life where a book kept them company at a dinner, over cocktails, at a happy hour, the way in which literature has been their friend when maybe they didn't have friends around. And then 3 days later, I found this kind of charming. Our guy Jeremy responded to his original tweet and basically said, like, "Hey, guys, after a night of reading at a bar, I was wrong. It was really mean that I did that. I don't know where it came from." And I just thought it was kind of funny for someone who was the bad guy of Twitter to come back and pull a "my bad." Obviously, the stakes were low, so he was able to do that. But I'm curious what you all think about this, because people got really mad. Did either of y'all see this and have any initial response when this was happening? Rachel, you seem like you did.
Well, I just read the thread, but I just love how much introspection was involved on his part. Like, I love that he gave this hot take and he was willing to rethink it so quickly and so hard that he actually went and experimented with it himself. Like, I thought that was so beautiful and like such a great example of like testing your opinion. But I'll also say that like one part of what he wrote that really stuck with me was him saying, like, "Some people do it to not be bothered, and I'm the most ashamed that I didn't clock that." And it's like, yeah, like, he was obviously thinking of a very specific type of person, but I've brought a book to a bar to, like, essentially, if I ever go out alone, it's supposed to be an empowerment activity for me that I very quickly regret and feel super anxious and self-conscious about. So I'll pull out a book to look like I have an activity to do, so I don't look like a complete and total loser who's just kind of like sitting around bumbling at a bar. So that's kind of my experience with reading in a bar. It was never to make anybody think I was cool, but more just to like be invisible. Yeah. So I really appreciate how much thought he put into like challenging his opinion.
Well, that's great. I agree with you there. And Billy, I have a specific question for you. You are, you know, now a New Yorker. You have been a New Yorker before. My imagination of the world is L.A., and Rachel could disagree with me, L.A. is not a big reading in bar city. I have done it. I've done it many times. We'll maybe talk about it in a sec. I would imagine that that is something you might see more of in New York. I'm curious if that's true or not, Billy.
No, because in L.A., you go to a bar to talk to people to find out what parts or jobs they've gotten, pretend to be excited for them, and then immediately ask, okay, but how did you get that? Like, sorry, do you have an agent? Like, where did that come from? And I definitely, if I've seen people reading bars, like it's definitely been more in New York. In New York, I was at a birthday party once, and one of the attendees, I don't know whether it was boredom or was feeling an extreme level of temptation or just need to grab himself, he just pulled out his Bible in the middle of it and was just reading there. And the guy who did that, very, very sweet and nice guy and very kind. But also, like, I couldn't help but feel like there's a little bit of performance in there. And I think that's really, you know, obviously it could be good, it could be bad reading the bar. It sounds like there are a lot of reasons to do it, and you know, maybe you're trying to mask a panic attack, trying to exactly as Rachel said, like pretend that you are completely just not existing. But like, I certainly, upon hearing the initial statement, and this is actually something that is important, I think, you know, I've heard this said about slogans and mottos before, and I think it's also sort of important for Twitter takes. If your Twitter take is unimpeachable, then that's a bad take. That's just a truism. You need to say something that is a little rough around the edges and clearly has some, well, okay, in this case, I'm wrongs to it, in order for it to actually be a take. And I think what I'm really latching on to is the very immediate image with this take of, we have all seen the performance of someone, whether it's with a scarf, whether they are ordering a drink they clearly know do not regular order, whether that's a martini or like a Fernet Branca or something like that. And they are trying to put on a performance half for the rest of the bar, but even more than half for themselves, to try to tell themselves, I am this type of person who is above everything else. So I certainly understand the intent behind this Twitter take. I also do love, yes, the acceptance of, okay, if we want to get into the specifics of it, I'll give this a try, and guys, it was wonderful, you know, thank you for proving me wrong. But I can certainly sympathize with the hatred for the charlatans who go into a bar with the, that's the thing, are you there to read or are you there to be seen reading? And I'm thinking of people who are there to be seen reading.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting, though, because a person reading at a bar, it's almost like a piece of art, right? Where it's like really about what the viewer is projecting onto them. So like when I see somebody reading at a bar, even probably if it was like a pompous douchebag, I would still probably think like, oh, that's so cool. They're alone at a bar and like so independent that they just got their glass of wine and they showed up. That's dope. But then like, I talked to my boyfriend about this thread and he was like, I know those douchebags. Like, I think it's kind of just like a reflection of your vibe in a way.
Well, I think there's also a where and a when, because I mean, I'll put my cards on the table. Haven't done a lot recently, but historically I've been a big bar reader. And I did it a lot too. When I lived in the UK, it was much more common to do there as well. So I got into it. And also in like the UK, there's places that are like coffee shops that are also pubs that transition that space between early in the day and late in the day, which is the best. But yeah, I think of a lot of times if I'm reading in a bar, I might be in between places, and rather than going home, I stop for a drink, have a book on me, so read for a bit. Or maybe it's like a happy hour or something like that, and I'm on my own, and it's normally a quieter bar. I think when you're reading at the bar as well, you pick where you're sitting. I think if you sit in the middle of the bar, it's a little peacocky. I think if I'm reading, I want to be at like an end or at like a table or a booth in a corner. So I'm not trying to show off. I'm making it very clear that I just kind of want to read and be off on my own. But it would be a weird thing to do at like Friday night at 10 p.m. if you showed up with a Dan Brown thriller to read at the bar. But I wonder, too, though, it's weird that we some people don't like this, but we've completely accepted as a society that the normal thing to do at a coffee shop is sit on a computer the whole time with headphones on, typing away while you nurse an Americano for 3 hours, which to me is much more egregious than casually reading at a bar.
I mean, you already got to what I was going to say. There is one, you know, all about like time and place and locate geography within the bar. And you also allude to the difference between, okay, even if we're calling all these bars, what is the atmosphere here? Is this a clubby bar? Is this a very busy bar? Is this a pub? And like sort of the more relaxed the atmosphere, the more like, okay, these are people who just happen to be having a drink and like this is just a general space, the more reading is appropriate. The more it is a place that people want to get hammered and find someone to fuck, like, that's like, what are you doing here? And again, I think that's what I am imagining if someone has the energy to and feels the need to call out a bar reader.
Well, here's a question too then. What's a better vibe? A bar or a drinking establishment where half of the room is on their phone on and off, or a bar where a few people have paperbacks? In my mind, the latter is way preferable. And I think, again, like we just give it a pass for, and once I've been this guy too, for neurotically scrolling Twitter like a psychopath while at the bar, that's okay. But, you know, reading a little bit is weird. I just think it's much more preferable from an aesthetics perspective.
I think so. I love a bar where people are reading books. That sounds nice. I did think it was interesting, though. This is kind of a side note, but I noticed a lot of people said that they read books to not be bothered. And I think it is interesting because maybe because of phones, but I've noticed people really don't mind bothering me if I'm reading a book. Like they think that because I'm reading a book, I'm bored and want to be bothered. I'm interrupted all the time. It's a really bizarre phenomenon. I don't know if you guys have experienced that, but it's like people see you reading a book and they think you need their company.
Yeah, because no one's going to like tap you and be like, oh, what are you looking at on your phone? Because that would seem crazy.
Yeah.
But they will be like, what are you reading? I mean, one of the last times I had a significant bar reading exercise was when the power went out in my neighborhood like 3 summers ago, pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And it gets very hot in the summer in Los Angeles. So I just like grabbed a book and walked to the nearest bar that had power on so I could be in AC with a cold drink, started reading. And these two young men next to me were very fascinated by it. And then wouldn't leave me alone. And then I ended up spending the night with these guys as if we all had sex. We did not have sex, but these guys started buying me drinks. And it turned out one of them was a former IDF sharpshooter who was in town to take meetings about turning his story into a film. Then he showed me the Amazon page for his autobiography called Disarmed, because in fact, once he turned, I saw that he was missing one of his arms because it got shot off in battle of some sort. So I would say it was an interesting night. I have a great story from it, and I wouldn't have had that if I didn't read. Eventually, he turned on me very aggressively when he asked my take on foreign conflict. Won't get into that here.
I do like, though, that initially he saw you reading a book and he's like, oh, there's a guy who likes a story. I'll go back.
100%. So, yeah. Have either of y'all ever had like a time that you remember reading a book in a bar or restaurant, something like that, where the book really gave you the companionship you needed at that time?
I don't have a time reading a bar. I did meet drunkenly a soldier once before who started talking to me in very graphic detail about his missions. I was on the Atlantic piers in 2013, like in the middle of a summer night, which is, you know, a mile to the west of where I live right now. And a man came up to me and my friends, and he said his name was Bruce. And that he was in the middle of drinking. I guess Bruce is also the name of a stand-up comic.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And this was a man who is not that stand-up comic, Bruce. But over the course of half an hour, This man very clearly messed up on a lot of alcohol, but just started telling us all about his time in Afghanistan and Iraq, about how to properly shoot an M4, which apparently the tip is you just want to make it so basically you have your fingers on the side of the barrel, so you're pointing at the thing you want to shoot at rather than worrying about the sight too much for your average.
And I just want to say that Wisecrack Industries does not endorse any type of automatic weapons training on the podcast. This is all the views of Billy and NBC Universal.
This is like the anarchist cookbook. You know, you can't stop it from existing. Like, if the information is out there. So, you know, maybe just Patriot Act it and see who listens to this podcast. And then, yeah, he was also talking about how we should come back to his apartment and look at the kill certificates that he had. Because apparently, according to Bruce, when you kill someone in the army, you're given a certificate of, like, yes, this is a confirmed kill, which I have never Googled since. I don't know if that's true.
A thing. He made them himself.
It didn't feel right. Like, even something as fucked up as the U.S. military, I don't think, generally speaking, on a bureaucratic top-down level, is issuing kill certificates. Maybe that's something that, like, you know, Alex Villanueva does, you know, in his spare time for sheriff's department people.
Rachel, have you ever had a bar reading experience that did not involve an encounter with a soldier? Or are we going to go three for three on this?
I can go the opposite direction, actually. I was, and this is kind of like where I wish I had a book. I was, it was really important to me to travel by myself for a while, so I went to Madrid and Sevilla on my own to kind of be like, you know, this is me being an adult in another country. Great. And that's where I very quickly just felt so awkward at every restaurant by myself. So what I really wished I had a book and I didn't. So I didn't have an activity and I didn't really have data. So I couldn't look at my phone. So I was just kind of stranded out there. And so what I would do, and in retrospect, for somebody trying to be an adult, did not succeed. But what I would do is I would sit really close to outdoor groups with dogs. And I would kind of try to pretend like the dog was mine or interact with the dog and pet the dog to just look busy. Because I didn't know how to just like sit still. So that's a case where, God, I wish I had a book or anything. Because I felt so lame being like, Golden Retriever, please, for the love of God, like, look at me so I don't look like a freak. Nobody saw me, of course, but that's how I felt.
Well, I think all bars should have dogs and books. It's a thing they should have. And good bars should have a little community library thing in the corner. So if you get there and realize you're in need of a book, you can just go grab one.
Love it.
Well, everything you've been describing, like, in terms of, free open library, some bars might be more appropriate because they're more coffee shops and like have that element to it. You're just describing Stories LA and Echo Park. Like this is a bar / coffee shop where it is okay and encouraged and necessary to go in and read. One last thing I'll add to is also, and this really gets into the whole idea of reading as performance, no matter how you're doing it, is a question of how did you bring this book to the bar? Is this, what did you have a backpack or a bag with you? And like, this is clearly, you know, as you're suggesting, like a paperback that you've been carrying around, you're in the middle of. Or do you mosey up to the bar, you know, order your, you know, your gimlet or whatever you're doing tonight to really, you know, stand out for the moment? And then do you remove a crisp hardcover, you know, page one from your breast pocket or something, and it's like, now I begin the reading? Because again, when it's something like that, it's like, this was not a naturalistic turn of events for you. You came here to read and be seen reading.
I kind of like that. No starting books in bars. You need to indicate that you're at least a chapter in. This is not where you go fresh. Although sometimes, you know, you buy a book at a bookstore, and as you're walking around town, maybe stop in a diner, a coffee shop, maybe even a bar at that point. But yeah, I'm curious to hear, we'll get to, at the end of this, we'll do our mailbag. We'll talk about how you can get in touch with us. But if you're listening to this now and you have thoughts on this, hold on to those thoughts, because we'd very much love to hear them. You can email them at culturebinge@wisecrack.co, because I'm curious if we're going to get yelled at for our takes on this. But, you know, more than anything, if Jeremy Schneider's listening, good for you for being willing to admit that you were wrong. It doesn't happen a lot, and it doesn't often happen on Twitter.com. And we could all use a little bit more of that energy in our lives because we're all occasionally wrong. Speaking of things that might or might not be wrong, the other thing I wanted to talk about today is, and we've talked about NFTs and crypto on this podcast before, because how can you not? Because it's a thing that we can't avoid at this point. But over the past couple of weeks, especially leading up to the Super Bowl, a lot of celebrities are now doing NFT endorsements and crypto ads and stuff like that. One of the things that I think got people started to get upset or confused about a week or two ago is when Eric Andre started doing ads for a Frank's Red Hot Sauce chicken bone NFT or something along those lines. And I think that confused some people because I think NFTs and crypto kind of do get associated with a type of like libertarian tech bro finance capital worldview. Eric Andre is someone who has associated himself not with that. I mean, I maybe it was performative, but I will just say I was a part of a canvas for a certain political candidate in Los Angeles in the 2020 election who would not be a fan of NFTs or know what an NFT is and would probably get cranky and just want to go eat a sandwich if you asked him about it. And I'm talking about Bernie Sanders. Eric Andre was campaigning for that individual. So, I mean, first I would just say, like, what are our general thoughts on celebrities and in particular, maybe people we might think of as cool or good jumping into the NFT game?
I've been thinking about this and I realized for me, the distinction was between celebrities and comedians. And that could be because I'm really in comedy myself. And that's like the world I'm in more. But for me, I think I felt particularly sad about Eric Andre because oddly enough, I think with comedians, I'm kind of like, your job is to be like, in a weird way, like your job is to like represent me and like to like be a normal person. Like, you know, like Reese Witherspoon, Gwyneth Paltrow, sure. Of course they're doing this kind of thing. But for Eric Andre, I'm sort of like, you know better. Like, we're supposed to think the same because you're supposed to, like, speak out against these things. Yeah. But I also realize that it's kind of fucked up to also hold comedians to these higher moral standards. But it was just, like, an emotional reaction I noticed in myself. I don't know if anybody else felt that.
No, there is a weird line there. I think, too, with comedy sometimes, for better or worse, there's this sense that, like, they're especially in like the alternative comedy scene, it's like the punk rock kids got inside the house and they're supposed to cause trouble, not make plans with the parents or something like that. Billy, what are your thoughts on this one?
I'm still trying to understand what happened specifically with this Frank's Red Hot bone coin thing. Do any of us know like what the NFT actually is at the core of this?
I'm not totally sure. And to be honest, I'm just starting to wrap my head around the thing as a whole. Is it something where you create an NFT with your bone coin or that the bones themselves become the NFT once they're used in an app?
I have to imagine, again, I have not yet done a deep dive on this, but it's so insane, and you so know what you're getting into when you hire Eric Andre, that it has to be, generally speaking, a joke. Even if it technically counts as an NFT, this has to be a gag NFT where they're not trying to, like, actually, you know, gin up capital and investment into whatever the hell bone coin is. But, like, to me, like, and I totally viscerally feel that distinction between celebrities and comedians getting into games like this. Like, even between celebrities and just good, talented celebrities, like, this is all the natural extension for me of celebrities getting roped into doing games, ads for pay-for-play mobile apps, like when Arnold or Kate Upton does stuff for like Age of Empires or whatever those things are. And it's like, this is all so embarrassing. Like, all of these games look nothing like what you're actually describing. They are just ways for kids on their parents' iPads to blindly spend $20 at a time buying, you know, in-game gold or whatever.
Those games are like borderline predatory in sort of how they operate. Like, yeah.
Take away the borderline. Like, they're in so many ways, I actually think they're probably worse than casinos. Like, there's no true, like, job-building social element there at all. And there's certainly no, like, number on the bottom of these of Candy Crush that says, if you need help today, please dial whatever. And so, like, but when I see Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I don't care about in any real way, do a commercial for, what was it, Mobile Strike, whatever the fuck, you know, it's stupid, everything is stupid, make $1 million. When I see John Goodman doing a commercial for what, Slot Mania, truly the saddest of all type of mobile games, mobile free zero prize slots where you are just a monkey hitting the button for cocaine, like, that's when I got really, like, I had to take a moment. But I can see the similar, yeah, slide that occurs when a comedian comes out for something like this. I'm just hoping that it's not real.
Yeah, I feel like the middle ground, or at least like during Super Bowl commercials, was because there were so many crypto commercials and NFT related things during the Super Bowl. Various celebrities involved, like LeBron did a thing, Matt Damon did a thing. The one that I feel like surprised the most people was Larry David's crypto commercial, because as far as I know, Larry David is not someone who's done endorsements in the past. And Larry David's also someone that has infinite money for the most part from his Seinfeld money and his HBO checks. So I don't know, we're either real surprised to see Larry David, and it was like, I guess, a self-deprecating crypto commercial. For those who haven't seen it, the whole premise is there's a Larry David guy in pivotal points throughout history where someone introduces him to a world-changing technology, and he does a classic Larry David, not interested, not convinced, blah, 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 to signify that he is the person who's skeptical of crypto, who's going to be missing out. But I don't know, did y'all react to that at all? Because I just found it kind of weird.
It's also so long. It's such a long commercial where they do the same joke like 8 times. It's crazy. I was sad to see Larry David up there too. I was like, maybe he just doesn't know what it is. Maybe he just doesn't know what it's for. But I think I'm just being a little too naive and innocent about it. But yeah, I was surprised to see him and kind of bummed out. Because again, Matt Damon, of course he would be in one of those. Like, of course. Larry David, come on.
Honestly, Matt Damon surprises me maybe even a little more. Because Larry David's just like, you know what? Take your, again, he's someone who will just like take some money. And I know that like in his heart, or at least again, I think in his heart, he's just like, well, this is stupid. This is a joke. But they want to pay me whatever the fuck. It's their loss. You know, whereas you have Matt Damon, who has narrated a documentary about Howard Zinn and like certainly knows all the ways that capitalism just repeatedly mines working class people for bad investments time and time again. I'd say he's a little bit more culpable to me. But yeah, especially too, like the Larry David commercial is, you know, trying to like this overly simplistic as like, oh, if you don't understand why, you know, NFTs and crypto are so important, then you're an idiot, without actually doing edgy education about why this is specifically good, because there is no answer for why any of this stuff is specifically good. It is entirely speculation at this point. It's the definition of speculation. Maybe this will pay off huge. It's just a buying frenzy. It is absolutely going to collapse any day now. It's not to say that the idea of a cryptocurrency in general that is independent of a government and is easily transferable, you know, in a digital cash-like way, or that NFTs, the idea of being able to assign, you know, essentially an all-purpose label of authenticity to a digital item, those, of course, can have uses. And even if you don't understand what those uses are yet, and I, for the most part, don't, I can trust that that's going to come along with innovation. But just the idea of we need 100 cryptos right now, and that's being very on the, that's on the low side. I'm sure there are thousands that are being started every day. And just sort of like, yeah, like maybe we'll buy 50 of these at 0.00100 zeros, 1 cent a piece, and maybe it'll blow up into a 1 cent a piece purchase and I'll get rich. Like, that's, it's not real. It's just fundamentally not real.
Well, and not to over conflate, you know, cryptocurrency and NFT, all those NFTs, they're in a similar wheelhouse. You know, we're recording this on Thursday, and right before we started recording, I did see that Reese Witherspoon's production company just announced a deal today where they will now be developing content like movies and TV based off NFTs. And what confused me about that so much is just like, why? Like, I've seen a lot of NFTs, but in my mind, I'm not like, going, you know, I can't see someone pitching a series that's about like the monkey with the ice cream cone or something like that. So stuff like that is where I am a little bit like, what the fuck is happening?
Okay, I have a really stupid question, but maybe other people have these too. Can an NFT be a movie, or is it just an image?
I think it could be a moving image as long as there is a original digital version that via the blockchain we can show that you own the original of. So I think, and I know there's NFT, there's music that's NFTs, but I think it's a digital work of art that can be blockchain traced back to the original version that you would have the ownership over.
Thank you so much.
I think
that answered it.
I think that's it. Billy, do you know more or less than I on that?
Well, I'm just like still like so confused about what the idea, what original means. Like I truly so much of this I'm trying to interpolate as someone who was into baseball cards and magic cards in physical forms. And it's like, okay, this doesn't matter. And there are 100,000 of this other baseball card. Why are they rare? It's just like, well, because people want to have them and you'd like some sense of, oh, this wasn't just made on a Xerox machine. So I can try to extrapolate on that and understand the idea of like, okay, you know, why would I want to own an NFT of, you know, a tweet per se? It's just like, well, it's something that's really cool. And just to be able to say, this is the one somehow. Yeah. Okay, great. The problem that I'm coming up against though, is that it's one thing if by buying the NFT of like some work of art, let's say like there was a Banksy or something that was an NFT. Yeah. If you want the rights to resell that, to use that image for commercial purposes, to license it, or in the case of like, if you want the life rights of the person who made it, like you want to make the story about the creation of the ape NFT, then okay, there's a lot that comes with that. But it does, when something is digital, it doesn't mean anything for it to be original, because the whole point of digital is that by breaking it down into non-analog bits, I can make an exact replica of it no matter what for an infinite amount of times, and there's no loss, there's no degradation. So there's no difference fundamentally, except by saying this is the original, that's something between what is an original and what is a facsimile.
Whew. Yeah. I guess we should move on in a second, but yeah, I just think in general, this sort of thing, it just seems complicated and slightly problematic from a lot of different angles. But I think, of course, also just gets back to the question of like, what can we expect from people that make stuff that we like? And I do not know the answer to that thing. But I'm not going to answer it because I want to get into our mailbag because we have a question that I think relates to this, so we can kind of keep a foot in this conversation, but also keep it moving. Before I do that, any other final, very specific NFT or crypto thoughts anyone had before we slightly segue out of this?
Buy now. You just got to get in before it goes up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everyone can't see this. Looks like Rachel is furiously purchasing cryptocurrencies and NFTs right now.
She's got a Nintendo Power Glove on attached to mm-hmm. her E-Trade.
I mean, all I could think about reading the articles, like just about primarily like white men being really excited about NFTs, was just like, this is just an MLM for guys. Like, this is an MLM
but
for them.
But don't
to do.
We deserve our own MLM?
Yeah, like guys love an MLM where like the goal is you get to feel smarter than everybody. Whereas like women do MLMs for like community purposes in a way. So I'm just kind of like, you know, have fun. Have a great time. Yeah, that's all I can think of.
You're making such an important distinction between benign stupidity and toxic stupidity. If it is just in the end of the day, like, I'll throw my money away. It's stupid. Like, if it's, you know, like, you know, watching the Beanie Baby documentary, all those women who really got it going, it's just like, I just think they're cute. Or, yeah, the idea of I want to have a Tupperware party and we'll hang out and we'll drink a little bit and we'll gossip. And, like, that's fine. And, yeah, maybe a few people do make money because, again, there's a real product to be sold there. But when you get into I'm doing this because it's the best thing and I'm beating everyone, that is truly, like, that's all QAnon is. It's a bunch of people who know they're dumb but want to feel smart. And so, therefore, they have to invent a story that they tell everyone and agree with everyone else that it must be true.
Well put.
Way to articulate that.
Yeah, well, y'all are really killing it right now. So if anyone does have pitches for dude-based MLMs, hit us up at culturebinge@wisecrack.co, or you can call us at 213-534-8807. I often kind of sarcastically remark that no one ever calls us anyways, but someone did this week, so we have an actual voicemail, which is exciting. But once again, hit us up at culturebinge@wisecrack.co, or call us at 213-534-8807. We got a lot of great emails recently, so just to say this as well, if you wrote one in and we don't get to it right now, we're going to backlog these because there's lots of good stuff here. But the first one I want to get to, because it relates to this conversation, this is from Charlie. The kind of TLDR of Charlie's very articulate email is, has success made some comedians' egos so large that they believe what they say is important, or have comedians genuinely migrated into an important role in society? And, you know, Charlie brings up some of the stuff we talked about last time around the Joe Rogan Spotify controversy, and then dropped the, you know, Whitney Cummings quote that got a lot of play last week, in which he said, comedians didn't sign up to be your hero. It's our job to be irreverent and dangerous, to question authority and take you through a spooky mental haunted house so you can arrive at your own conclusions. Stay focused on the people who paid taxes to be moral leaders. Sorry for the interpretive reading, but I love the idea that comedians are supposed to take you to a haunted house. But yeah, I think, not to read the whole email, but the very end of it, Charlie says, has success made some comedians' egos so large? Yeah, they believe what they have to say is important. Or are they important? Interested to hear our thoughts. So I'm curious what you all think about that sort of dichotomy Charlie brings up in relation to some of the recent goings on of comedians who talk or tweet. So yeah, are they important? Do we make them important? Is it just a matter of ego and success making people think that they are skilled orators about society?
I honestly think it's both. Like, I think, like, there are people who obviously listen to them and, like, give credence to what they say. And I think they also, I'm sure, imagine that they are important and are more, like, I'm so sorry. Can you guys hear that?
Yeah, but it's awesome.
Yeah, we, you know what? Dogs get sad sometimes, too. Yeah, so Rachel, is to get back to Charlie's question. Has success made comedians' egos so large that what they think they say is important? Or are they important? Or neither? Or both?
I think that it's both. I think that, like, I think in a weird way, if you think about it, like, this could be giving comedians too much importance, which I definitely don't think they deserve or have earned in a lot of respects. But if I think about, like, it's almost humiliating to say this in a podcast. But if you think about, like, Plato and Socrates and how they're, like, talking about how they're, like, speaking out to people all the time and philosophizing, like, that's essentially what comedians do now. Like, the average person, unfortunately, isn't, like, looking up all these philosophers and they're like, what do they think? I think a lot of people consume philosophy via comedy, which is wild, because comedians are arguably, like, not the best people to be doing this. But so I think, like, I think it is kind of fair to say that, like, what comedians say does matter, because we wouldn't be having all these conversations about Joe Rogan if that wasn't true. That said, I do think comedians aren't always ill-equipped to be giving the most informed and best takes and can feel a little self-important. And then you get comedians who, the more popular and successful they become, they become more and more disconnected from society and are therefore, like, less able to comment on it in an intelligent way or a thoughtful way. So it's actually kind of interesting that I think as their ego, and this is complete armchair philosophy, but I think as their ego grows and the more important they think they are and the better takes they think they have, the worse it gets. So that's my take. I don't know if any of it's legitimate, but I'm curious to hear what you guys think.
No, I'll second pretty much all of that. Also, like, it's a very broad question, like, the answer to which all of it is, like, just, you know, yes and no to both sides.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a question of, like, you know, if you want to say, like, okay, no, comedians in general shouldn't be having a platform, or they're not, you know, thought role models or thought leaders, then you're very quickly getting into Laura Ingraham shut up and sing territory, where it's just like, no, we pay you to entertain us. And, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that every single comedian, you know, especially if you want to just talk about it as a large field that includes, you know, people who do open mics and everyone who's doing improv, like, you know, doesn't make any of all of them thought leaders. I mean, what it comes down to, I feel like what's at the heart of this question is, should we allow someone who is known for doing comedy, which we generically think of as being unimportant or, you know, sort of by definition silly, should we allow them to have serious takes, you know, that aren't made to make us laugh? And should those takes like influence our opinions? It's like, I don't, if they're smart takes, then yes. But yeah, like certainly you have plenty of people out there who have, you know, an elevated platform, you know, Joe Rogan most of all, who is not particularly smart and who is not particularly scrupulous in terms of filtering the information he brings into his show and then amplifies. And so should people listen to him and take what he says? Obviously not. But at the same time, like, you're also asking the question of, like, it's also a question of, do people listen to Joe Rogan? Well, yes. It's like the Charles Barkley, like, I am not a role model thing. You rephrase that as, people shouldn't look to me as a role model. Yes, that works. But you are a role model before you even said you're not. That's not something you get to choose.
Yeah. Without restating any of what y'all said, which I agree with, I know it's boring to agree, but I do. Only two things I'd add. One, I mean, I just think from like an audience perspective, it's always important to remember that, like, if you are looking towards, whether it's musicians, comedians, actors, to be your sort of like critical, anti-capitalist, whatever, heroes, someone is going to not be successful in relation to that. So no one who has a massive platform and is the most famous of them all is going to have that perspective, because keeping that perspective really aggressively is going to preclude certain opportunities. There's reasons why there's a lot of people in comedy, I'm sure, who we all like, who are kind of on the margins or do decently, but are not absolutely crushing it. And there's other times where people who are maybe a little edgier in their younger days soften up their message as the checks start coming in, which I'm not even going to judge. I haven't been in that position. Who knows what that's like? I would dare someone to put me in that position, and we'll see how I do. The only thing I think in relation to this, to very sloppily riff off a point that Sigmund Freud, not a comedian, makes in Civilization and Its Discontent. Freud in that book gets in this idea that, like, we all just want our daddy. And maybe we call it real daddy or God, but for some of us, maybe it's like our podcast host or the comedians we like or the athletes we like. And when we all just want daddy to tell us what to do, it creates a dangerous situation. And we have more daddies around than ever before. And it leads people into turning people like a Rogan into their new daddy, so that they have some sort of North Star in existence, so that they don't feel like they're just like alone and rudderless in a reality that makes no sense. Not saying that that gets people off the hook, but I think we have a tendency as humans to do that. And I think a lot of what's going on now plays right into that tendency. So, you know, kill your daddies, friends, not your real ones. I don't know, maybe they suck. Kill them if they suck. This relates to this, and I'm going to get to this email real quick. We talked last time. I very recklessly in my chat said that I thought Mike Schur's philosophy book was stupid and that no one should read it. We got a couple emails that basically said, like, fair enough, man, but, like, I'm finding it kind of helpful and interesting. What else should I look at? To be fair, Mike Schur, do whatever you want. Get as much money as you need. And it's great for people to read about philosophy. And honestly, like, better to read Mike Schur trying to interpret Aristotle than whoever making up their own shit. But to be nice, someone asked, they were basically like, then you tell me what to fucking read, asshole. Fair enough. A couple of books I'll say really quick. A really fun book is called At the Existentialist Cafe. It's by an author named Sarah Bakewell. It's like a narrative account of all these French existentialists, including like Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, both their philosophy, but what it was like for them, like, hanging out in Paris at cafes, coming up with ideas, and also has juicy gossip stuff like who they slept with. There's an Oxford book series, Very Short Introductions. They're all really good. So, like, the Very Short Introduction to Plato or Heidegger or Foucault or whoever you want to read. Those are great. A French philosopher I like a lot, Alain Badiou. He's written a series of books that are aimed at French high schoolers. But in translation, they're really good. One is called Ethics. It's great. He has two books called Manifesto for Philosophy 1 and 2. The other thing I would just say as well is the novel The Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse. Or is it Hesse? Hesse? I always say it wrong. I think that's a very fun introduction to philosophical thinking. And, you know, I would just say all of those people, at least those who are alive, can probably use the residuals more than Michael Schur can. But if that book is helpful, I'm sorry that I yucked anyone's yum. It's a thing I try not to do. Before we wrap up, we have a voicemail. This is very new for us. This is very exciting. We have not had a voicemail in legit like a year. So producer Maddie, feel free to press play and we'll see what happens.
Hey, Wisecraft, this is Jackson. I was calling in because I wanted to discuss a little bit of the Spotify news from last week, and namely whether or not corpos should be ethical and can we actually bring moral change by voting with our dollar. I think in a best-case scenario, we can convince corporations that it's profitable to market their products as environmentally friendly, inclusive, but only to an outward appearance. Much like Apple touting their planning being carbon neutral in 2030, but they have a long history of fighting right to repair and producing more e-waste because of it. With my cynical take of voting with your dollar, I would like to argue that this act of financial protest is more of an act of catharsis in a world of mega corporations that seem to be above the law. For example, Microsoft in the 90s with the Netscape antitrust and is now buying up Activision Blizzard. Until a company can make something like Hypnotoad in an ad, we're typically the final say in a transaction, and that can give people a sense of power in a world of never-ending global pandemics and voter rights being endangered. And as per Raymond's request of me assigning D&D roles to you guys, Raymond would be a Beastmaster Ranger because he sounds like a great dog dad. Rachel would be a cleric of knowledge because of reciting the holy text of Tolkien. And Michael, I honestly think you'd be a College of Eloquence bard because some of the tweets, 50-50, they're honestly like you casting vicious mockery whenever you're just on fire. All right. Awesome show. Long time listener. Love hearing you guys. All right. Bye.
Oh, thanks so much. Wait, did he say his name?
Jackson?
Jackson.
Okay, great. What a good name. Okay, so, and that's great too, because one of the emails we had as well was similar to Jackson's, asking that question of like, basically, like, can companies be good and can we like do ethical things with our spending? Or what do y'all think about Jackson's take there?
My whole thing is that the problem with the idea of either companies or even individuals being ethical with their purchasing decisions is it's very hard to do. And two, it's by far the least efficient way of getting to any of those larger answers we're looking for. And this, like, I've actually, like, for years, like, avoided the label socialist because, like, I'm someone, like, who is very interested in the way that, like, markets work. And I do think there's a lot to be said for understanding things in terms of supply and demand, things like that. But when it comes down to, like, okay, how do I actually find my business? Oh, I absolutely believe in socialism in the sense of not even, you know, what are the things that are human rights or so to speak that the government should take over for, but what are the economic matters that it is inefficient for individual people or corporations to handle on their own? What do we basically need bulk purchasing decision-making power in order to affect proper change and to be most efficient with? And something like, you know, climate change can only be done efficiently, really, from the top down, with the government saying, you can do this, you can't do this. And as soon as we're in a position where individuals are trying to make those decisions, you know, then even though some people are going to make good hard decisions, for the most part, you can depend on the void they've created, you know, in this case, in an overall carbon tally, to be filled by other people saying, okay, well, I'm going to get away with even more on my side then. Like, so it's almost impossible to do that. It doesn't mean people shouldn't, or that we shouldn't do what we can to hold companies accountable. Like, I certainly, like, have withheld dollars from certain places. I don't use Spotify, but I'm certainly not going to listen to it about the Joe Rogan stuff. And, you know, I think Neil Young is doing a good thing and that real movements can get started. But at the end of the day, like, it's all so necessary for any of these big problems where individual incentives can't be felt or are not easily aligned to be done from a top-down governmental level, so that it's just not something people are thinking about. And also, it's inefficient in the sense of we're wasting time having to think about it, just like it's inefficient for people to have to focus on, do I have my privatized health care and therefore do I have to stay with the job I hate? Just have everyone pay for each other's health care, and then you can go around and try out a new job you're going to be better at.
I agree with Billy and with Jackson in that, like, thinking about it in terms of climate change too, it's like the kind of gaslighting that goes on, like, to individuals that sort of like, well, if you recycled more, the earth wouldn't be dying, which is like just very not true. And what corporations tend to put on like us as individuals, where the reality is like the responsibility is with, like, you know, the government to keep corporations in check to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. So I guess I like what I liked what Jackson said about catharsis too, because really, in a cynical way, like deciding not to do Spotify or deciding to recycle is just purely for like your own sense of being like, I was a good moral person today. But it doesn't necessarily, it's just a drop in a very, very, very big bucket. So I think it is the kind of thing where it's like, if you do want things to change, perhaps easier than trying to convince every individual person to recycle, to not use Spotify, to like ditch Amazon or whatever, is perhaps to get everybody to vote and have the government handle those things. But I know our government's also not great. So all this to say, everybody eat a donut today.
That's a great thing to make people do. I like that. Everyone should eat a donut. Yeah, I agree with you all. I agree with Jackson. And I really think that catharsis point is important, because I don't want to judge or begrudge people who make ethical decisions about their consumption on the basis of them trying to either do what they can or have a clean conscience. I think that's fine. But I do think that catharsis and that desire for catharsis comes from a feeling of kind of like helplessness or impotence, because we have not in our lifetime seen any really huge examples, and maybe a couple exceptions, of consumers or, you know, people that are not corporations or in government who have been able to make large-scale social changes that have made people's lives better or made the world more like ethical or whatever it might be. And I think it's totally fair for people to feel beat down and helpless and just needing to feel a little bit of something. And maybe that is not giving money to a corporation. Of course, in real economic terms, if you don't give your money to the bad corporation, another corporation will pop up, which will gladly take that money from you, which best case scenario might be neutral. But I also think, like, I don't think corporations are good or moral in the same way that they're not tall or short. It's not a part of what a corporation does. And anytime we see a corporation attempting to do that, all it is PR and marketing. They want us to feel like they are good, so we feel like we are spending our money someplace good. I wish we could all have solutions other than like eat donuts, but I think that's the move for right now, is like eat donuts and like think about what we could do to become more powerful.
No, and I would just add, like, if you do want to talk about corporations in a moral framework, then that requires having rules for all corporations that prevent any individual corporation from acting in an immoral manner or funding immoral ends. Then you don't have, again, it's all about getting to a point where we shouldn't have to worry about it if we had the right system in place.
Amen. Yeah. So thank you so much for that voicemail, Jackson. It's great to have our first voicemail in a while be great and have a lot of thoughtfulness to it. So we appreciate that a lot. We appreciate everyone who calls and emails. It's half the fun of this, is getting to chat with you all. So again, hit us up at culturebinge@wisecrack.co. Call us at 213-534-8807. Again, you could tell us what you think about reading in bars, celebrities, and NFTs, and crypto. Or if you have thoughts on the Winter Olympics or anything else, you can hit us up there. Thanks for Rachel coming back 2 weeks in a row. Really appreciate it. I'll feel you back soon. Rachel, tell people where they can find you in the meantime if they want more of your thoughts, opinions, and advice on which pastries to eat.
Oh, and there are a lot of them. You can find them at Vaness Express on Twitter, or you can find my little comic drawings at Vaness Expressions on Instagram.
Everyone, go subscribe to those right now. Pause the podcast and do it. Billy, besides watching your work on Saturday evenings on NBC, is there any other place online people can find you? Any other thing you're working on that you want to plug while you're here?
You can help me as I get back onto Twitter now. If you want to help me rebuild my follower count, you can follow me at Billy Domino. Or if you want to similarly see what I'm I'll share anything that's my sketch that gets online to my Insta device account, which is at Duraflame Logs, which is the only moral corporation, is the Duraflame Log Corporation.
That's true. And that's a great follow, because I think the first few episodes of the season, I was very much trying to discern you're very, and I mean this genuinely, it might sound like I'm sarcastic. One reason I love Billy so much, super unique comedic voice, and it's so great. And it's been fun to, it was fun to try to predict things, but it was also great on your Instagram when you take the guesswork away and let us know where your voice gets shown on national TV. And it's so exciting, and we're so glad to have you there. So hopefully your next break from the show, you can come back and talk to us.
I would love to.
Yeah, and you feel free to bring Lauren Michaels on. Love to talk to your boss.
Yeah, so, he's gonna. Yeah. He'll do it.
Does it? Is the rumor that he likes popcorn a lot? Is that a thing that people talk about? That Lauren Michaels eats a lot of popcorn?
I have heard this rumor about popcorn. I have not seen him eat popcorn, but I have heard this rumor.
Okay, well, this has been another episode of Poppin' with Lauren, the only podcast that keeps track of Lauren Michaels' popcorn consumptions and rumors around it. Come back next time. But thank you so much, Rachel and Billy, for being here. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks, as always, to producer Maddie for making all of this lovely stuff happen. And then, obviously, if you care at all, you can follow me on Twitter at Michael O. Burns, similar on Instagram. And I'm all over the Wisecrack YouTube channel, so go there if you don't already. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.